Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. Today, I am all by my lonesome. No one is joining me. Typically, on an episode of PCMC, I'm joined by one of the Rogues Gallery. But today, we are talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire from 2024. And this episode is a little bit of a sequel episode to episode 213, which was on Ghostbusters Afterlife. That was another episode where it was just me alone. And I think the reason I do it this way is because Ghostbusters is a very important franchise to me. I'm deeply connected to it. It's the first fandom that I was ever really a part of. And it's still something that is intimate to me. So since it's so intimate, I say, you know, light a candle, sit back, and let's just you and me talk about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. So if you are a fan of the Ghostbusters franchise and you're new to Pop Culture Man Children, we have other episodes on other installments on this franchise. Episode 51 of PCMC is just an overall franchise episode up to that point when it was recorded. That was with me and Chris Sorrentino. Chris Sorrentino is a sort of active member in the Ghostbusters fandom. He's known online as Real Ghostbusters, spelled R-E-E-L, Ghostbusters, because he has this ongoing project where he takes scenes from all of the movies and he renders them in the animation style of the Real Ghostbusters cartoon. He's also the person who does the artwork for this podcast. The image, the PCMC icon is done by Chris Sorrentino. He's a really brilliant artist. As I said before, episode 213 is the Afterlife episode. Episode 263 is the Ghostbusters 2016 episode, also known as Ghostbusters Answer the Call. In that episode, I was joined by frequent contributor Anthony Bongiorno. And that was not a hateful episode. We like that movie. I still like that movie. At the end of this episode, I'll give my current rankings for the Ghostbusters movies. And then quite recently, episode 322 was on Ghostbusters Part 2. We did it for New Year's Eve episode because I consider it a sort of a New Year's Eve movie. And I did that episode with Peter Marsh from the Lassercast. So let's give some credits on this movie before we dive on into it. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is directed by Gil Keenan. It's written by Gil Keenan and Jason Reitman. It stars Paul Rudd, Carrie Coon, Finn Wolfhard, Kumail Nanjiani, Patton Oswalt, McKenna Grace, Logan Kim, Celeste O'Connor, Emily Ann Lind, James Acaster, Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, Ernie Hudson, Annie Potts, William Atherton, and many more. The music for the film was done by Dario Marinelli, who has done other things like Atonement and Pride and Prejudice, The Darkest Hour. He actually did not do the last film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, but it is a similar score, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. The cinematographer for the film was by Eric Steelberg. He did do Ghostbusters Afterlife, as well as all of the Ahsoka series and Juno and Up in the Air. He's worked a lot with Jason Reitman. So, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. This film, as I'm recording this, I'm recording it the Monday after its opening weekend. It made an estimated $45 million, which is around what the last film made. But this film cost about $100 million to make, whereas the last film was cheaper. It cost $75 million. So it is a success. It was number one in the box office, but it, as of now, is not a huge success. Let's look at the Rotten Tomatoes scores of all the Ghostbuster films. Ghostbusters Part 1 has a 95% fresh rating. Ghostbusters Part 2 has a 55% rotten rating. Ghostbusters 2016 has a 74% positive rating. Ghostbusters Afterlife has a 64% positive rating. And Ghostbusters Frozen Empire has a 42% rotten rating. So as of this moment, Ghostbusters Frozen Empire is, as of looking at this metric, the lowest rated of all the Ghostbusters movies. The only other rotten one is Ghostbusters 2, which comes in at 55%. So it is not getting a lot of love from critics, and I can understand why. But it is getting a lot of love from fans, which is also, you know, understandable. I think Rotten Tomatoes is an interesting thing to always consider, but you need to consider it with a grain of salt, because film criticism is itself a craft, and it is a nuanced thing. And most reviews have positive and negative points that they make. And for Rotten Tomatoes to work, each review has to be taken and someone has to decide. And I don't know exactly how this process works, but someone has to decide whether it is a positive or a negative review. And then it gets put in the positive or negative pile. And that's how it all accumulates. So you might have a film that has a lot of positive ratings, but if you go to actually look at those positive ratings, you might see some repeating negativity. But it's interesting nonetheless. This is a Ghostbusters film that was highly advertised and marketed. I think too much. The original Ghostbusters did a lot of interviews. The new Ghostbusters did a lot of interviews. There was a lot of trailers and TV spots. I got to a point about a week or two before the movie came out where I stopped looking at things because I felt like I knew too much. And when you get to that point where you feel like you can piece the film together with the little puzzle pieces you have in your mind, then it ends up being usually an unsatisfying experience. So just so you know, if you're new to this show, my feelings on, I won't rank them yet, but my feelings are that I love Ghostbusters 1984. I think it's a classic comedy. None of the others have ever really reached that level. I love Ghostbusters 2. I love Ghostbusters 2016. I love Ghostbusters Afterlife. And as of right now, I like Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. Maybe one day I'll love it. I don't know. These ratings and feelings change over time. When I first saw 2016, it was so not the film that I wanted it to be. I felt very disappointed by it, which I think a lot of people were. But as time's gone on and I just look at it as its own film, I find that it's really funny and really creative and enjoyable. It's just not the film that anyone wanted at the time. And of course, a lot of the backlash against it comes from either obvious or subconscious misogyny. So what we're going to do for this episode is we are going to do a list, which everyone on the internet loves a list. Keeps things nice and clean. So we have some main sort of headlines to go through. Stuff that worked for me. Stuff that didn't work for me. Stuff that had potential but didn't quite get there. Miscellaneous odds and ends. And finally, the future of the franchise. What I want from it and where I know it's going. I should, of course, say that this episode is entirely spoilerific. I am assuming that you have seen Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, or you don't care to see it, but you care very much about what I feel about it. So do not listen to this if you plan on seeing it and you don't want the entire thing ruined for you. So let's start with our best foot forward and talk about the stuff that worked for me. Every Ghostbusters film starts with a cold open, and this one does as well. This one begins in 1904, and it begins with a sort of an incident involving the main big bad ghost in this, which is named Garaka. And interestingly, it begins with the firehouse, but we see the firehouse that we know. In front of it are, old-timey, like, brick streets, and it says 1904. And we see firefighters coming out of the house, which is a very, very clever way to begin. And the firefighters are going to this scene where Garaka, who is this sort of ice-cold demon, has frozen this room full of people. This is great because it establishes one of the main settings of the film, which is the firehouse. Early on, the working script and the working production name for this film was Ghostbusters Firehouse. And now that I've seen the film, and I should say I've seen it three times, I think that that's the title they should have stayed with. Because not only does it begin with the firehouse and tell us a little bit of the history of the firehouse, more than any other film, it takes place in the firehouse, We see multiple scenes in the firehouse. We see parts of the firehouse no one has ever seen before. The firehouse is seen really as a domestic space for the first time, outside of the real Ghostbusters where they lived in the firehouse. In this film, the family, which is the same family from Ghostbusters Afterlife, they live in the firehouse. It is their home. They do laundry in it. They live in it. They eat in it. We see all of their bedrooms. We see multiple places. We see an attic, which you've never seen before. It's super run down and old, which is part of its charm. But as I said, the ghost in the film, the main big bad, is Garaka, and he is this ghost that has, he has, you know, Elsa from Frozen powers. He, like, screams at you, and the scream freezes you, and he can freeze anything. At the end, you know, a lot of New York City is all frozen because of him. And we find out throughout the story that in ancient times, the people that fought Garaka and imprisoned him in this orb were called fire masters that used fire to fight him. So fire and ice become these sort of central themes, which again, it brings in the firehouse, which was always there in Ghostbusters, but gives it this great meaning. Another thing in the film that I like a lot, and I know some people don't like things like this, but I love them, is that in the world of this film, Ghostbusters did not only exist, but it was a phenomenon close to the phenomenon we had in reality. There's a scene very early on where it's a New York One news report about the family that lives in the firehouse that are the new current Ghostbusters. And it talks about an accident that they have at the beginning of the film that causes a lot of damage. And the New York One anchor says, "This is the most damage that Ghostbusters have caused since the Statue of Liberty debacle from 1989, which is, of course, a reference to Ghostbusters Part 2. But then in the news report, they show the Ghostbusters video with Ray Parker Jr. and the Ghostbusters dancing in the video. They show toys, the commercials for the Kenner Ghostbuster toys. They show a commercial for the Ghostbuster breakfast cereal. And it's this world in which not only does the song exist, but Ghostbusters was so popular in the 80s that these real people, these real Ghostbusters, actually led to toys and all sorts of merchandise and a song that everybody's familiar with. And I really like that because going back to The Force Awakens, which for Jason Reitman, the sort of new mastermind behind Ghostbusters and the co-writer of this and producer of this and also the writer and director or co-writer and director of the last film, Afterlife, he said that The Force Awakens was sort of his guiding light in a sense for how to do Afterlife, for how to do a legacy sequel. And in that film, they made Luke Skywalker and his adventures with his friends legends that everybody knows, that all the new characters knew about. And I think that's great because what it does is it puts the audience watching the film in the exact same place as the characters within it. The characters within it know all about it. And in this case, with Ghostbusters, the characters within it know that Ghostbusters was a song that everyone knows and knows that Ghostbusters was toys and Ghostbusters was a phenomenon. And I think that's a very cool way to ground the film. So next on my list is that it's a family story. It takes the family from the last film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, which is single mom, Callie, and the kids, Trevor, played by Finn Wolfhard, and our protagonist, Phoebe, played by McKenna Grace. And this time around, Paul Rudd, who was just a love interest in the last film, Gary Gruberson, is the sort of stepdad. They're not married, but he's in a relationship with Carrie Coon. And actually, another element of the story that I like is he doesn't exactly know his place in the family. He doesn't know if he can be, you know, hard on them, if he can discipline the kids, if he can act like their dad. It is a family story. It's not just a story for families, although I think it is, but it's a story about a family. The Ghostbusters in this film, the four Ghostbusters, right, are really, you know, mom, her boyfriend, and two kids. And on a certain level, that doesn't make a lot of logical sense because the, you know, the kids are 18 and 16. But also in this fantastical world, you know, it doesn't really matter. There are jokes in it about labor laws and how they're breaking labor laws. And one of the main plot elements for the protagonist, Phoebe, is that they get in trouble in the beginning and she's benched. She's told that she can't go Ghostbusting anymore until she turns 18. And she feels kind of lost by this because in the first film, and by the first film, I mean the last film, Afterlife, she sort of finds her way in the world as a Ghostbuster. She becomes defined as a Ghostbuster. There's a sad scene in this where the rest are pulling out in from the firehouse and she's left behind. And she's like, but wait, I'm a Ghostbuster. And of course, you know, it pulled my heartstrings. In many ways, Ghostbusters Afterlife was a children's film. And to hear me talk more about that, go back and listen to the Afterlife episode. But moving on from there, this film is almost more like a YA, young adult film, because it's still got themes of family and it's still got young protagonists, but it also has higher stakes, a little bit more danger, and also some romantic elements for the young characters. It seems to be doing the Harry Potter thing of, as the characters grow, the story will kind of mature with them. So now we're in this YA space. I think this would be a good time, bouncing off this, to talk about some of the criticism of this film and even the last film, which is that Sony, who owns Columbia, who made the original Ghostbusters, and who is the entity that owns this project, this property, they want to turn Ghostbusters into a franchise as lucrative as Star Wars or Marvel or Transformers or any of those things. And many people have been writing think pieces over the last week saying, you know, do we really need this? Maybe there was only one ever good Ghostbusters movie and none of the others have been good. If that's the way you feel as a viewer, then I can't argue with that. I understand that. Me, I like these films and I also like this concept. For me, Ghostbusters and, well, the ephemera around it and the idea of busting ghosts and the idea of spooky haunted houses and the idea of proton packs and, you know, blending sci-fi and horror and fantasy really, really works for me. So I do like this and do want more of this. But the idea that I would argue is the idea that Sony is just doing anything to create a franchise. Well, you know what? Let me step back for a second. Sony, the giant corporation, is doing anything to do a franchise. Sony wants a franchise, and I'm sure they don't care how they get it. But I do not believe the creators, the actual artists and artisans behind the film and the last film, are themselves this cynical. Because if they did, what they would do is they would have redid Ghostbusters, but made sure that the entire cast was male, so no one gets upset like they did on the 2016 one. They would have picked some hot people, they would have picked hot new comedians. The Ghostbusters would have been like Pete Davidson and, you know, whoever else is young and good. They would have had four of them and they would have put them in the mold of the original Ghostbusters. It would be a zany comedy, but without too much cursing and violence, so young kids that still want to see it could see it. But that would be the cynical way to do it. I think when you look at the last two films in the series, especially Afterlife, where it's set in a rural setting outside of New York, these are not the decisions made by cynical people that just want to do a cash grab. You wouldn't make such daring decisions. You wouldn't challenge the fans and the audience in these interesting ways. You wouldn't really try to do anything interesting. I mean, I guess an example that comes to mind is the Super Mario Brothers films. There was one in the 90s that was very, very weird and different, and I love it, but it was not a big success. And then they made one recently, which I found entertaining, but was as safe a bet as possible. It had all of the Mario characters that you know. It had the most well-known villains, the most well-known storyline. It sort of feels like they took all the storylines from all the games and just put them into an AI machine, and an AI machine made this sort of very safe Mario movie, which is fine. But that is an example of how you make the movie that just gets you the money, prints you the money, and no one has anything bad to say about it. No one has anything great to say about it, but no one can complain about it. from the time Jason Reitman came on board to now, this idea of making the protagonist a little girl and making it this family story and making the four Ghostbusters two adults and two children and having this family drama, that is in no way the easy choice. So yes, Sony does want more Ghostbusters, and Sony will keep making more Ghostbusters. If this film doesn't make back its money, they will probably go in a different direction and do another reboot or do another whatever. But I think what you've seen with Ghostbusters, going back to the 2016 version, is the most derivative Ghostbusters film is Ghostbusters 2. It's almost a, you know, carbon copy of the first film, but fans love it because they saw it as kids and because it's got the original four guys and it's got their unique chemistry. But really, that's the most derivative film. 2016 does really interesting things, more than just gender swapping. It adds different backstories. It just does everything differently. It takes the same ideas for the tools in Ephemera, but sort of does them in a different way. And of course, these new films are these sort of family adventures. So back to my list of things that worked for me. The character podcast played by Logan Kim. He was in Afterlife as this sort of round-faced, sweet little kid. And it's been so many years since they filmed Afterlife. You know, Afterlife was filmed, but then because of the pandemic was shelved for over a year or so. He looks so much older in this. Both of the kids do. And he ends up being the funniest part of this movie. He's no longer, you know, a Ghostbuster the way in Afterlife the two kids and their two friends, Lucky and Podcast, become the sort of de facto four Ghostbusters. In this film, as I said, it's the central family become the Ghostbusters, but Lucky and Podcast are there. And Podcast has the funniest lines. And I think in general, something to be said about this film is it's very funny. One of my complaints with the last film was that with its sort of dramatic family tone, it actually didn't have a lot of comedy. And that was very off-putting for a lot of people because, you know, essentially Ghostbusters is a comedy. So to make this film in this universe that's not really a comedy was a weird choice. But this film feels grounded in the same universe of the last film, but actually has way more comedy, way more comedic characters. It's not as funny as the original Ghostbusters because I feel like it has what I would call like Marvel movie comedy. Its world is a world of adventure and a world of action. And the comedy comes mostly in the form of funny dialogue from characters. Often like silly, stupid characters that say silly, stupid things. This is very different from the original two films, which were, you know, at their core, comedic. It wasn't just funny dialogue, but comedic premises. Everything about it was that world of comedy. So in that respect, another thing I really liked about this film was the character of the Firemaster, Nadine, who's played by Kumail Nanjiani. Kumail Nanjiani is a brilliant comedian. He was in The Eternals. He wrote and was in The Big Sick. He's a really great comedian, and he, in this film, is a character, I'd say, very much in the mold of, like, a Lewis Tully, Rick Moranis' character, or Janusz, Peter McNichol's character from Ghostbusters 2. He's sort of this outside character that sort of gets swept up along with the Ghostbusters. He's this normal guy who something sort of magical happens to him, and he becomes a part of the whole story. Even though Kumail Nanjiani is of Middle Eastern descent, he is... he's not depicted in a sort of racist way or a xenophobic way, the way Janusz was in Ghostbusters 2. He is this character who sort of starts our plot by selling this orb that he inherited from his grandmother to Ray, because Ray has a YouTube channel where he does videos about possessed items, and he sells it to Ray because he just wants to make some money, and he doesn't realize what's in that this beast... Garak is inside the orb, and he doesn't understand that his grandmother and his lineage are these fire masters who their job was to keep Garak at bay. And, you know, fire master, it brings to mind gatekeeper, key master. And at the end of the film, or throughout the film, he begins to manipulate fire. And then at the end, he can manipulate fire. He becomes basically a firebender from Avatar. And at one point, very cool moment in the movie, he manipulates a proton stream. So it's very, very cool. And he's really, really funny in it. He adds a lot of comedy to it. And he has good chemistry with a lot of other people, including Bill Murray. So something else that worked for me was this sort of subplot of Trevor, the older brother, and his relationship to Slimer. Slimer lives in the firehouse, very much like the animated series. And I should say that one of the things on this list is how much I feel like this movie feels like the animated series. And that's something that the creators were aiming for. But Slimer in this is done mostly practically. He is a puppet that was actually molded from the original mold and then CG enhanced. But you can feel that it's a puppet. It feels like Slimer. And he's got this sort of like subplot where he's kind of trying to catch Slimer. It's a lot of fun. So the thing that maybe works the most for me is McKenna Grace's story, Phoebe's story. She has found herself as a Ghostbuster, but is told by the mayor that she can't be a Ghostbuster anymore. And she kind of feels left behind. She feels like she's lost her identity. And interestingly, that ties into and reflects Ray's story. Of all the original Ghostbusters, Ray is in it the most. And he's not just a glorified cameo. He's really in it. He's really a character in this film. He has a lot of scenes. He has his own arc. He has its own story. And he kind of is sad that he's older and that he's not out with the Ghostbusters anymore, that he's not in the car anymore with the proton pack. He feels kind of melancholy. There's a scene that I really like, which I described before, where the Ghostbusters leave and they leave Phoebe behind, and she's sad watching them drive out of the firehouse. But then we see Ray in his bookstore, which is, I believe, close to the firehouse. It's not totally clear. In the video game, it's right next door. But I believe from the what I can understand of the geography of this film, it's close, maybe down the block. And he's in his store at night, and he sees the Ecto-1 in the street, and he sort of perks up and looks at it sort of longingly, and it's sort of like he misses those days. Another thing that I liked a lot, and this is, and possibly I like this because it's one of the only things that wasn't ruined by the trailers, so it was such a pleasant surprise, but Phoebe's storyline involves building a friendship and a little bit more with a ghost named Melody. It's a ghost of a girl her age who died in a fire. She meets her because when she's sort of left behind and feeling lonely, she goes to play chess in the park, and the chess pieces start moving on their own like they did in Afterlife. In Afterlife, it was Egon who was playing chess with her. So she kind of thinks that's what's happening, but then it turns into this girl. And then it ends up being a very funny scene because the girl's like, "Why aren't you scared of me?" And Phoebe was like, I'm so sorry. You want me to act scared? Again, it's a good, funny moment. But they build this very sweet relationship. It's very, very heavily implied that they have a crush on each other. So the Phoebe character is in some way queer, which I love. And the idea of a ghost not being something evil, but just being a ghost, just being someone with unfinished business and making a friendship with her, it's the kind of thing you did see a lot in the cartoon. The ghost Melody is played by Emily Allen Lind, who was in the Babysitter movies. She's very good. I think young audience members would really like her character. And, you know, there was a reflection between she feels sad because she's going to be, unless she can cross over and be with her family again, unless she could finish her unfinished business, she will be stuck as a teenager forever. And similarly, Phoebe feels sort of stuck and left behind as well. So they're both sort of left behind by their family. And it's very sweet and cute. This film, I think, does a better job than Afterlife in creating a balance between dramatic moments and comedic moments. So another thing on my list is, and this is something that was probably ruined for you if you saw any trailers or any of the marketing, which is Annie Potts' character Janine at some point gets into a uniform. And again, this is something that really harkens back to the Ghostbusters animated series and the toys, because there were Janine toys with her in a jumpsuit. And it's very cool to see her in the jumpsuit. It's one of the many elements that makes it feel like the cartoon. Another thing on my list of things that worked for me is Garaka, the villain. Garaka is a entirely CG creation, but it works very well because it's sort of very, very tall and spindly and has these long spider-like fingers. And it's not a presence that you would want anything sort of human to do with it. In fact, Garaka doesn't appear a ton. A lot of Garaka's machinations are happening through other people and other designs. Even when Garaka speaks, you don't totally even understand what he's saying. He only says things in English a few times. It's a very cool looking monster. It's sort of gray and black and has these big horns on its head. It kind of floats around. It has these cool powers. The last film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, went back to Gozer, which I guess is understandable for the legacy sequel thing. But I'm so glad that this film introduced a new ghost. And again, this is the kind of ghost I feel like you would have seen in the animated series. Another thing that really works in this film is Bill Murray as Peter Venkman. Other than Harold Ramis, who obviously passed away and isn't in this film, Bill Murray is the original Ghostbuster who's in it the least, but still he's not a glorified cameo. He appears in the middle in a pretty interesting scene, and he appears in the end in the final battle. He's there. You don't get this feeling like he's not there. He's not as intricate in everything going on the way Ray is or the way Winston is. Winston is the Nick Fury of the Ghostbuster world. And we'll talk a little bit later on about how they are trying to sort of make a cinematic universe, for better or worse. But Peter Venkman's very good in it. He's funny, but he doesn't steal the show. You get a sense that he's a little older and takes things a little bit more seriously. He has a great scene with Kumail Nanjiani. He's good in it. He's very good in it. And you're not sort of sitting there waiting for him. You know, I think when it comes to these legacy sequels, there's always a right balance one has to strike between the new characters and the old ones. Even if you love the new characters, and in this case, I do love the new characters, there's still part of you that defines the whole series by the old characters. And as we saw with things like Star Wars, depending on how you depict the characters, depending on how much you depict the characters, depending on whether the characters live or die, or how long they are in the film, can have a huge effect on the way the audience reacts to the film. You might know the story that when they were making The Force Awakens, with every draft of the script, Luke Skywalker was pushed later, 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 until the version that they filmed where Luke Skywalker doesn't appear until the very, very end of the film and doesn't say anything. Because they felt that once Luke was there, all you cared about was Luke and you wouldn't care about the new characters. And that's sort of what happens with Ghostbusters Afterlife. You have a scene with Ray early on the phone, but then the original Ghostbusters appear at the end. In this, the Ghostbusters are around. I think it works in an organic way. One of the funniest moments in the film that was ruined by the second trailer, which I almost wish I hadn't watched because I think it would have been such a great moment to be surprised by, is there's a very funny scene with Paul Rudd and Carrie Coon where he's trying to convince her to stay and to fight, and he quotes the Ghostbusters song. But he makes it like he's having a conversation. He's like, listen, if there's something strange in the neighborhood, who are you going to call? It's very funny. And then the punchline, which you might know from the trailer, is he says, let me tell you one more thing. Busting makes me feel good, which is, you know, I don't know when busting became a euphemism for ejaculating. I feel like it was the 90s. It could have been earlier. But it's a joke everyone has made since then. So it's funny that the film makes it. And again, it shows that in this world, the Ghostbusters song exists. Although that goes back to part two. In the beginning of Ghostbusters 2, they go to that kids' party and they dance to the song. So the song existing in the world is not a new thing. But some of the more funny moments I really wish had been saved for the film. Part of me wonders if it was a marketing decision because the first film was not very much, it was very much not a comedy, although it had comedy in it. And by the first film, I meant Afterlife. And then the first trailer for A Frozen Empire didn't have any comedy in it, which I think made people go, okay, but what is the tone here? So the second trailer had a lot more comedy in it, I think, to tell the audience, look, this is a comedy, but I wish some of this stuff had been saved. Something else I like, this is small, minor, there's a new ghost called Pukey that's this cute little ghost that sort of rolls on its head like a sort of weeble wobble and it pukes. That's good. That's good old-fashioned fun. One sequence that could be very fan servicey, but I think ends up working really well. It's really well made. It's really funny. It's really exciting. Is the entire sequence where Ray, Podcast, and Phoebe go to the New York Public Library to meet Patton Oswalt's character, who plays a librarian who helps them research and understand Garaka. It's a funny scene. We see a cameo, if you will, by the actor who played the library administrator from the original movie. Patton Oswalt is very funny in it. He has some really funny lines in this, like real jokey stuff. I think one of the funniest lines in the movie is in this scene from Podcast. It's fun to see Ray like working with little kids. It's fun to see a cameo from the library ghost from the first film. It's not too much. It's really a tiny little cameo, and it's enough to be like, oh, cool. But also, it's not what the whole scene is about. And one of the more interesting things that this film does is while Patton Oswalt is telling the story of Garaka, we see it animated on the screen, and it's done in a way where it's sort of stop motion animation, but through like carved stone. Or chiseled stone. So it's this interesting animated sequence in the middle of this film explaining Garaka. And it's just, the whole thing works really, really well. There's a ghost in this film called Possessor who can possess anything. He possesses one of the lions outside of the library. The kids and Ray go to the library on a motorcycle with a motorcycle sidecar, which is very cartoon-like. There's even a button on it where a proton pack comes out of it. It's like, this is, it's so much like real Ghostbusters. It's fantastic. One thing that I love is that in the last battle, everyone's there. Every character's there. All the Ghostbusters are there. The new Ghostbusters, the old Ghostbusters, side characters. But there's a point where everybody but Phoebe is frozen. And it's Phoebe alone against Garaka. And I love this because it is her story. She is our protagonist. And I love that they give her that moment. You know, I was worried, especially because she wasn't in the trailers very often. I was worried that this film was going to forget about her and was not going to be grounded in her. And I'm so glad that it was grounded in her story. It continues to be her story. In some ways, Ghostbusters Afterlife and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire work together as a duology way more than Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2 do. These two most recent films really are telling the same story about the same character. It continues from one into the other, and it's a story, you know, about growing up. So it's, I think it works super well. One last positive before I get into some of the other stuff. Much like the last film, Afterlife, which a lot of people said had a Amblin kind of early Spielbergian feel, this film also does. In fact, there are scenes and shots from both Afterlife and this new film, Frozen Empire, that are directly out of E.T. In Afterlife, when Phoebe finds Egon's secret little laboratory and she's approaching this shed, it's very much Elliot approaching the shed where E.T. is. And in this film, Trevor tries to trap Slimer by putting junk food on the floor, and Slimer's hand kind of comes out and grabs it, and it's exactly the shot where E.T. grabs the M&Ms. And also, as you may have seen in the trailers, this movie takes place in the summer, and as Garaka sort of takes over and all of kind of freezes everything, you see people on the beach start to freak out as these sort of shards of ice start shooting up out of the beach and out of the ocean. And there's images from there that are right out of Jaws. And I find it interesting that Ghostbusters is an 80s icon, but a lot of the vocabulary they're sort of pulling from is this other 80s stuff. All right, let's move on to the list of stuff that doesn't work for me. And I do want you to understand that I do not think this is a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination. It is a flawed movie, and we're going to go over those flaws. As a matter of fact, I think that as a film on its own, Afterlife is a better film. Afterlife holds together as a film, where this one doesn't as much. I don't know if you could walk into this film without having seen Afterlife and really understand it. So let's get my petty thing out of the way. They need to use the song more. I said this in the Afterlife episode, and I'm saying it again. They play it once at the end. It needs to be at least twice. It needs to be cold open, you play it, and then maybe you play it in the middle, and then you play it at the end. I don't know if it's a, like I said last time, I don't know if they're trying to be classy or if they, you know, are afraid that somehow it doesn't fit the tone, which should be an indicator then that your tone might be off if you're afraid that playing the Ghostbusters song will ruin your tone. Part of me also wonders, and this is real in the weeds, that maybe there's a resentment to use the song because actually the Ghostbusters song that they use in the films now, although it sounds almost exactly like the Ghostbusters song we all know and love, it's actually a version made around the time of 2016. And if you're familiar with Taylor Swift, she redid all her music as Taylor's version because she wanted to own the rights to both the recording and the actual music so she could get more money. That's what's happened with Ghostbusters. The version that you hear now, the version that is licensed now, is sort of Ray Parker Jr.'s version. And eagle-eared fans like myself can listen to both, and you can hear slight differences. And it's really because Ray Parker Jr. would get money from the publishing, and he wanted a bigger chunk of it. And so now the only song he will let you license, he won't license you the old one because it doesn't make him as much money. So he will only license you the new version. So part of me wonders if the producers are like resentful to him for this. So they do it, you know, although I don't know. I don't know how it works. It might cost exactly the same to use it than not. I mean, I don't know if you pay more if you use it more. I have no idea if that works that way at all. I'm completely open and honest about how naive I am to that, those sort of aspects of filmmaking. But that's just a thought. All right, let's get to the biggest flaw in this movie, which is there are way, way, way too many characters. There are way too many characters. We're following way too many people. This movie is overstuffed. It's got too many characters. It's got too many subplots. It's got too many stories. I love Podcast. Like I said, I think he has the funniest line in the movie. But Podcast could easily not be here. I mean, the last film took place in Oklahoma. And we know that the kids and the family moved to New York to live in the firehouse and become Ghostbusters. But with Podcast, we're told that he's interning with Ray. Okay. And then Lucky, the other girl from the one who was sort of Trevor's love interest from the last movie, she's there and she's interning with Winston. So they're both interning, and it stuffs it. It makes it way too, there's too much going on. There's too many scenes that could easily be cut. It's like we're not, I mean, if Phoebe's not in the scene, you don't need it. So that's really the main problem. Even when you get to the final battle, there's like 900 people there. I mean, the fire, and getting back to the firehouse being a central theme, the final battle in this film takes place in the firehouse, which is cool. But it's stacked. You've got everybody in there. It's just, there's just too many fucking people. As much as I love Patton Oswalt, I wonder if Patton Oswalt's character and Kumail Nanjiani's character could have been combined so we have less characters sort of coming in to do just one little thing for the motor of the plot and then coming out. Patton Oswalt's character, although part of the marketing, really is only there in that one scene as a librarian. And although he's very funny in it, and as I said, I think it's a great sequence, he's really there to give exposition. Maybe have Kumail Nanjiani do some of that. There's a character in the film named Lars who is an English guy, and he works for Winston. And he works, Winston shows us in this film that he has this paranormal research center where they are looking at, there's a huge new containment unit, and there are all these scientists studying ghosts and studying different apparatuses to use in ghost busting. And I'm not the first person to point this out. It's in a lot of the reviews. This stuff, and Lucky, who is a part of this stuff, and Lars, who's a part of this stuff, feels very, very much like what I would call Marvel homework. It feels like they want to do a movie with just Lars and Lucky, or a movie with just Winston's little laboratory. And so they've got to set that part of the world up. There's a whole couple of sequences in the center of the film where it can drag a little bit, where it's just Lucky and Lars, and it's them in the little lab. And it's like, this could so be cut right out. And you feel like this is only here. Lucky is only here because she's going to get her own spinoff. Or that's at least what they're intending. And that's the kind of sloppy filmmaking that has made Marvel go downhill so much in the last 10 years or longer. You know, if it doesn't serve the story, it shouldn't be there. So another problem I have with the film is that the score is once again just a reworking of the score from the original film. Now, in Afterlife, this was cute because, again, it's a legacy sequel. And it was interesting the way they took this sort of jaunty metropolitan kind of like comedy beat and turned it into this sort of like rural kind of dramatic theme. But they do it again in this film. Not as much, not as obvious to give it credit, but they do it again. And it makes me feel like it should have been entirely unique scores. Especially because you don't want to use the Ghostbusters theme. So why are you relying so much on the score? Like, yes, I do believe the score of the original Ghostbusters is a huge part of the formula. But you're not even doing that kind of film anymore. So you're taking the score and you're reconfiguring it to be the mood that it is now. It's odd in a way. So another thing that doesn't work is something you may have seen in the trailers or TV spots, which is the quote-unquote new proton packs. Believe it or not, despite having Winston's, you know, secret laboratory and showing them working on all these new ghost-busting gadgets, it actually doesn't amount to much. Janine seems to have, like, a proton wand that, like, is connected to her arm, which I wonder if that's an homage to the toys, because the original action figures, they don't hold the proton wand. It kind of is anchored on their arm. And then there are supposedly new proton packs. But the only major difference I can see is that there's yellow in it instead of it being solid black. It's not big changes. If you want big, interesting changes, you want to go to Ghostbusters 2016. Because that film actually did a lot with interesting new Ghostbusting gadgets that this film really doesn't do. So one of the main problems with this film, flaws with its story, is how wildly convoluted Garaka's plan is. Garaka's plan, and even I'm going to stumble through this because I don't totally understand it, is Garaka's in this orb, but he wants to get out of this orb. But he can't get out until a human being says the magic words. But he needs to be a human that says the magic words. It can't be a ghost. But Garaka also has this power to control other ghosts, which you think would be a big deal, but it doesn't really add up to very much. In the end, the reason he comes to the firehouse is because he wants to empty the containment unit and use all the ghosts the Ghostbusters have ever caught as his own army, which, of course, that doesn't happen. But it's just so convoluted. It's just like one thing to another thing to another thing. And it's like, how would he even know? The character that I told you about, Melody, we find out that Grock is actually using her to manipulate Phoebe. In the end, she turns against Grokka and shows that she really does care about Phoebe. It's one of those things where she's supposed to betray her, but halfway through she feels bad about it and she says to Grokka, like, does it have to be her? Because she really has feelings for her, but Grokka's like, yes, it has to be her. And so Phoebe has to fucking... oh god. It's so in the weeds. There's a machine in this film that can extract ghosts from possessed items. So Phoebe goes in it herself and sucks her soul out of her body, leaving her body, I guess, dead? I don't know. And so Phoebe's a ghost for a minute because she wants to, I guess, ghost kiss Melody, which doesn't happen, which I conflicted about. Part of me feels like, don't be cowards. Go ahead and have them kiss. But then part of me is like, well, the character's supposed to be 16. Maybe you don't want to do that. Have a 6-year-old kissing. But she does that because Garaka is going to possess Phoebe's ghost and make Phoebe's ghost say the magic words. And while her ghost is saying it, her dead body, kind of, I guess, is also saying it, which will let him free. It's just like, wow, how could Garaka have planned so much ahead of time? It's wild. It's so convoluted. And another big part of Garaka's plan, and this is another thing that I think does not work in the film, it's just a bridge too far, is there's another ghost in this film called Possessor. And as I said before, what Possessor can do is he can possess any inanimate object and make it move. And Possessor, like, goes out, escapes out from the lab, and then follows them to the library. And then when it's in the library, it steals the record that has the magic words on it, and then it goes in to a garbage, it's a garbage bag, and then they chase the garbage bag, and then it goes into the concrete lion outside. And it's just like, what are we doing? Although it does have, I think, an interesting ending payoff where possesses a proton pack and aims it at Trevor's character, who's going to kill him, and shoots the proton pack. But Kumail Nanjiani uses his power to bend the proton beam away from Trevor, saving him. And then Possessor possesses a pizza that's on the counter, and the pizza crawls away, and then Slimer eats it. Which is a cool ending, because that means Slimer ate another ghost, which is the moral implications of that are wild, but it gives a moment for Slimer to do something heroic. The last thing that I'll say doesn't work is Walter Peck as the mayor. It's a cute idea, but it feels way too fan servicey, and it also feels like it doesn't fulfill its potential, because although he does have a couple scenes where he and Phoebe argue, you want Vakeman to say something to him, anything to him. And in the end, all Vakeman says to him is Vakeman calls him a clown, which is like, come the fuck on. And then, you know, the way it ends, and I'm ruining everything for you, but the way it ends is the Ghostbusters save the day, and then Walter Peck as the mayor comes and he wants to arrest the Ghostbusters, but there's a big crowd of people cheering on the Ghostbusters. So he's forced to sort of thank the Ghostbusters and go along with them. And someone in the crowd, he says like, Walter Peck says something along the lines of like, I'm not sure what I should do. And then someone in the crowd screams, maybe you should thank them, dickless. Which is funny, but you know what? Bill Murray should call him dickless. God damn it. Bill Murray was the one who called him dickless in the first movie. He should call him dickless in this, not clown. It just feels like, you're waiting for him, and because him and Bill Murray were it's them in the first movie that are real antagonists to one another. I mean, it's him and Murray the whole way through arguing. So the fact that they don't even really meet again until the end and then nothing happens, it feels fanservice-y in the way that it doesn't add anything. You know, the Ghostbusters always have a connection or a relationship to the mayor of New York. So they wanted to do that in this film, which totally makes sense. But making it Walter Peck, it's just like, it should add up to something, and it really doesn't. And one last thing I'll say, and I say this reluctantly because I am not 100% sure that what I'm about to say is correct. But there's a scene where, and I guess it's supposed to be a comedy scene, where Garaka, when he comes out, he goes because he wants to find Kumail Nanjiani, the Fire Master. And he goes to a vape shop that's called Fire Masters. And he goes in and he's like, are you the Fire Master? And the guy working there is like, what does the sign say? And then he freezes the guy. There's a moment where you see all of these products. And I don't know if they're real products or not, but if they are real products, that means that there's product placement for tobacco products in this film. And that is not cool at all. Okay, now let's talk about a few things that I think had potential but just didn't quite get there. One of them is the CG. Some of the CG looks very good. Some looks bad. And some of it has that sort of green screen feeling that... It's not green screen, because green screen has a flat feeling. But it's that thing where you... And we're all getting good at recognizing this as viewers. It feels like the environment isn't real. You look at the firehouse and you look at the street around it and you're like, that's not real. A lot of what we're looking at isn't real. And it can be distracting because there are moments where things could be practical, but they're not. Some of the ghosts, I think, look really good. Some don't. There's a sewer dragon that I think really kind of looks like a video game character. Garaka looks good. Slimer looks good. But some ghosts just don't look good. And there's also a part where the containment unit is breached. And you see a bunch of, like, very, like, man-in-sheet-looking ghosts fly out. And it's like, well, man-in-sheet-looking ghosts is not really what Ghostbusters ever was. It just, some of the CG just ain't there. Okay, and the biggest thing that had potential that didn't quite get there, and this breaks my heart because it's something that I personally have been wanting forever from Ghostbusters, which is with the character of Melody and the relationship she builds with Phoebe. This movie begins to do something I've always wanted Ghostbusters to do, which is to question the morality of capturing ghosts and putting them in a containment unit. There's a scene where Melody is in the firehouse with Phoebe, and Phoebe's giving her a tour, and they go down to the basement, and Melody is in front of the containment unit, and Phoebe's like, this is the, and Melody's like, oh, I know what it is. And she, like, puts her hand on it, and she sort of has this wistful look, like she's looking at it like it's like jail. And then there's a scene, and I love the scene, by the way, for Dan Aykroyd's performance, but then there's a scene after where Phoebe says to Dan Aykroyd, and she calls him Dr. Ray, which I think is cute. She says, Dr. Ray, have you ever thought about what it'd be like to be a ghost? And he says, every day of my life, which is very sweet. He performs it so well. He's so Dan Aykroyd in this. He is the heart of the Ghostbusters. But it seemed, I wish they would follow that through line, because it seems like they're beginning to really think about what the moral implications are. And also in Winston's little laboratory, some of the ghosts are in enclosures, almost like they're being studied, like they're in a zoo or something. And it made me wonder, like, it made me really think for a moment in the middle of this film, oh, at the end, what they're going to do is, because there's, I haven't mentioned it before, but there's a through line that the original containment unit is too full because they never emptied it. And so it can't take any more ghosts, so it's sort of failing. I thought, okay, they're going to dispense with the containment unit and they're going to find a new way, you know, and I don't know how they're going to do it. I thought maybe they might find a way to make ghosts cross over, like in Casper, like maybe the Ghostbusters will find a way to get them to come off of our mortal plane. I really thought they were going to get there, and it feels like there's germs of that in the story. It would be such a great ending to the story of this character, Melody, this ghost character, and it would be such a great step forward for the whole franchise, but sadly the potential is squandered. Okay, let's move on to some miscellaneous odds and ends. One thing you'll notice if you've seen any of the trailers is there's a lot of material in the trailers and the marketing that do not appear in the film, which makes me feel that they were tinkering with this movie up until the very final moment. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's how all film works. I mean, a great many great films were a complete mess in the making of it, but they somehow pulled it out at the end. Some classic films. So that's not necessarily bad, but it creates weird expectations. There are whole scenes and moments that are in the trailers that aren't in the movie, and even some story threads. And some of this, by the way, is good. There is a moment in, I think, both of the trailers, or every trailer they did, where they are describing that Garaka kills you by fear itself, which even in the trailer, you're like, but doesn't he just have ice power? And in the final film, Ray says something to that effect one time, but it's dropped. Whereas you see a scene in the trailers where, like, I guess it's being described to the family, and Paul Rudd's character is like, you mean being actually scared to death? And I'm so glad they cut that, because that's not what Garaka does at all. Maybe in some version of it, it was, but I'm glad that they cut out that messiness so it works better. Another thing that's almost the entirety of the, at least the opening of the second trailer, is this whole long soliloquy by Walter Peck, where he's talking about the Ghostbusters, and I've waited 30 years for this, and these guys were frauds, and it's this whole thing, and almost none of that dialogue is in the final film, which is good, because there's a moment in that dialogue where he says, there were no eyewitnesses, which immediately made me go, like, but didn't Marshmallow fall on you? Wasn't that your big comeuppance? And also, how were there no eyewitnesses to the Statue of Liberty thing? But it's cut out of the film, so plot hole, averted. Another interesting thing is in the original, in the first trailer, there's a scene where all the city is all iced over, and all of the Ghostbusters are up on the roof of the firehouse, and they're wearing these red parkas. And the Nerds Online went crazy and they wanted to buy them. And then the company that made the parkas made their own Ghostbuster ones. And they sold them for an insane amount of money. I think like over $1,000. Because they're like real deal, like worker parkas. Like they'll keep you warm. And then that's cut out of the movie. So there's only a few scenes where you see the parkas, but you don't see them all wearing it. It's not very visually obvious. So I just imagine people who spent a ton of money on those parkas just sitting there being like, oh, they cut it out of the movie. That's just, I think, an interesting thing always, especially because even now I'm still seeing TV spots that have lines of dialogue and moments that are not in the final film. And it's just odd. It's a little odd to me. So a lot of the criticisms of the film are posing the questions of like, who is this for? Well, I think the answer is children. Obviously, the nostalgia stuff is for the older members of the audience. But really, the story is for young people. It sort of has the logic of young people. You know, even in this world, like Ghostbusting, you know, in the 80s, Ghostbusters was, it was a business movie. It's a going into business movie. It's very sort of like, you know, Reaganomics kind of movie. And this, it's like a magical family. I don't know. Like, it's not a concern of a young person, so it's not a concern really of the film. But that's the answer. And when people say that these films are not about anything, or you know they're just cash grabs, I think you either don't like the new characters, or you never really give them a chance, because there are new characters there that are interesting, and we're telling stories about these characters. I guess the last thing I want to say, and this is something that's just been on my mind for a while, which is that Ghostbusters fandom, like a lot of fandoms, has a lot of toxicity in it. And it's maybe the toxicity doesn't reach the levels of how toxic like Star Wars fandom can get. But sadly, I feel like the toxicity in Ghostbusters fandom is more baked into it. You know, a lot of like Ghostbuster fan pages and places on the internet and people on the internet who are otherwise very warm and welcoming, there's sort of a consensus like Ghostbusters 2016 is just the worst thing. You know, I saw a reaction the other day to a video. I believe it was Screen Rant or IGN. No, I think it was IGN did their review, and they gave it a lower rating than 2016. And look, it's just some nobody. But somebody wrote a comment that I can't stop thinking about where they went, how could this have a lower rating than 2016? That's the worst movie ever made. And I keep thinking those words, the worst movie ever made? How? You know, it's not important enough. It's not bad enough or good enough to have that strong a feeling about it. If to you it's the worst movie ever made, I'm sorry, you just don't like women. Look, if you don't like it for genuine reasons, you don't like the writing or whatever, fine. And you don't want to be put into that barrel with those other people, I understand that. But you know what? It's up to you to look at the company you're keeping. If the conversation ends up being filled with vitriol, like the worst movie ever made, there's a problem. There's a disease. There's an infection in this community. And I will always be a Ghostbusters fan, but Ghostbusters fandom to me is a very personal thing. And it's about me, and it's about my family and the kids that I grew up with. And I like some of the larger fandom and the online community, but I'm not a card-carrying member in that way, because I think there is a lot of it that's just gross. So what's next for this franchise? Well, the director of Frozen Empire, Gil Keenan, recently was talking about a Netflix animated series that had been announced, and he was questioned on it, and he said that it's in full development. He's seen scripts from it. He's seen character designs from it. He thinks it's going to be very good. I'm totally for this. I'm for Ghostbusters animation, I think, is cool. I like the original Ghostbusters animated series. I like Ghostbusters, Extreme Ghostbusters. I think animation and Ghostbusters goes together very, very well, and I'd be happy to see more of that. It does seem like they want to spin off some of the characters and situations from Frozen Empire into its own films. I'd be for some of that, you know, if it were well developed and it were actually, you know, doing new interesting things. You know, all I want for me personally is for things to be new and interesting. You know, it's such a fertile ground. I mean, it's basically the concept of there are ghosts and you catch them with cool sci-fi instruments. And it's got a fun sensibility. That's it. Within that, there could be so many crazy things you can do and all these different media. Now, the animated series, I don't know, or it's not been said yet, if it's about the original Ghostbusters or if it's about Phoebe and her family or if it's about some other time or whatever. I hope that it's not. I mean, obviously, I'd watch it if it was. But I hope that it's not about the original Ghostbusters because I would like to do something different now. And I think that's, you know, and it's the same thing I say about most franchises. You know, these things do mean stuff to people because of their potential. But then that potential often gets squandered out of fear. Go ahead and make all sorts of different weird Ghostbusters movies. That's what I would like to see. All right, before we go, let me give you my ranking of the Ghostbusters movies. And I would almost say, all right, it's weird to have a complicated answer to a question I posed myself. But I would almost say that I think every Ghostbusters film is a little bit worse. You know, I would go 1, 2, 3, you know, 4, 5, 6. Although I'm not entirely sure about the middle. I'm not sure. I really don't know which I like more, Afterlife or 2016's Answer the Call. They're both good in different ways. And then there's the idea of, you know, the difference between your favorite thing versus what you think is objectively good. Ghostbusters 2 is maybe objectively the worst Ghostbusters movie. But because it's got the original guys and it's because I saw it as a kid and, you know, it's so connected to part one for me, you know, it's always going to be up there as one of my favorites. Now, you could look at that and go, well, you've just described the literal definition of diminishing returns, which is true, but they're not huge drop-offs to me. You know, like I said, I like this stuff. I love Ghostbusters, and I like 2016. It's funny, and it's clever, and it's interesting, and I like Afterlife, and I like all of this stuff. You know, the one thing that people have been writing about recently, which is, you know, Ghostbusters is not like Star Wars, where you had the original trilogy, or if you want to be even more particular, the original two, okay? And then Return of Jedi comes out, and people have problems with it, and then from then on, there's issues. People are saying, well, Ghostbusters just is one classic movie, and then the rest aren't good. If that's the way you feel, I can't argue with you. But to me, I do feel like the first one is classic, and nothing else can touch it. But I feel like the concept is interesting enough that all of this other stuff I think is still interesting to me. You know, in the end, I have to be honest and say that criticism is a craft and it's a personal thing. And I always find it disingenuous when critics, especially professional film reviewers, sort of present this air of objectivity, which I think is not possible. First of all, I think you could have a bad day and you could like a film less than you would have liked it if you were having a good day. Or you could eat a bad meal and it makes you dislike a film more than you would have liked it if you had eaten a good meal. I think that is a normal part of all human beings. But also I think, you know, that my feelings on Ghostbusters that go back to my childhood are always going to make me less objective about new Ghostbusters films. You know, if you're somebody who's not my particular age group and maybe you know the original Ghostbusters or you like it, but you didn't see it when you were young, it doesn't mean anything to you. You will say, you know, you'll think I'm crazy. You'll think, oh, well, this movie's messy. Like you said, there's too many characters, there's too much going on, and why are we even doing this? That's fine. Look, I'm completely willing to say that maybe I just like this stuff because I like this stuff. I don't think that makes me a bad critic. I think I'm honest enough to tell you that criticism is always subjective. It is. It doesn't matter what other critics pretend to be. Criticism will always be subjective. But listeners of the show know that one of our main contributors, Janine Gagliardi, has a little boy named Peter Gagliardi. And he is a tiny little baby boy. No, he's a big boy now. But he's a little kid, and he loves Ghostbusters. Now, was it introduced to him by his millennial parents? Of course it was. But I've hung out with this kid, and he's into it. He's as into it as I was when I was his age. And there's not even a cartoon that's on all the time. Now, I think they do watch the cartoon, but that's just the power of streaming. The point I'm saying is, I don't think it's only for people my age. I think that it does have something essential in it that makes it special, especially for kids. And I have said this before, and I'll say it again. I think it's because it essentially says that the things that scare you should be laughed at. There's a certain bravery that comes with making fun of scary things. And I think that's what makes Ghostbusters special. This has been PCMC. I'm Mike Buongiorno. We end every episode by saying, go bye-bye.